Our last day, and I see that there are still a lot of people here. That's amazing. You have been wonderful throughout the whole week. I'm actually, I know that some of you are leaving in the mid of this session or the next session. So we can also treat this as the final and concluding word of the marathon, but obviously the presentations are coming. So in case I don't have a chance to talk to you again, then it was a pleasure to host you here. And I hope you enjoyed marathon. Expect a questionnaire coming in into your email, because we need to report our participants like the event. So then once you get the email, please do respond and tell us whatever you liked or whatever you did not like. So that's like for the whole week. And now for today, as you see in the program, there are two slots for this session, and slides are still coming in, which is excellent. See, again, well, so whoever is ready to present or need to present now because of flight constraints or whatever, just come here, hijack the computer, hijack the mic for the recording, and present what you have achieved during the week. If we are finished with the presentations too early for this session, then we'll stop the session. You can keep working on your projects and come back after the coffee break, which will be at 11. So those who are presenting now should present just those about 15 minutes at most, and let's not use the rest of the time, because we'll actually gladly use it for our experiments. I still want to run something and so on. So whoever is ready and knows that his slides are also in the version he would like to present, just come down and tell us. So any volunteers? So what do we have? Core and Coref, yeah, okay. No, klidně i mí.
Okay, so this is the final report, but the work is still not finished, as you can see later. The final report of the project called CoreFMT, and me and Lian been working on it for this week. So what was the task? We did a research, how can coreference help in translating other words than pronouns, like disambiguating the senses. So for example, he bought the bread and cut it into pieces, and cut can be translated to different Czech expressions. So, and we don't have much information from it, what should be the cut, or how should it be translated. So we can project this information from the antecedent of it and use it to translate or to disambiguate. So what was the baseline? We are using Tech2MT, which is a 3-to-3 MT system implemented in the Trix framework. And it's a English to Czech translation, and the translation model is a discriminative model built for every English lemma, where the classes are the possible Czech translation for every lemma possible Czech translations, and this discriminative model features are extracted from the current node, its parent, children, and the preceding and the following words in the surface ordering. And the features are lemma and morphosyntax, like general morphosyntactic pattern, part of speech, or grammatical features. So this is the baseline, and we added a new feature, or several features coming from the core reference. So we integrated the Stanford Core NLP core reference tool, and designed and ran five experiments. Like, first was a baseline, and then replacing the child's lemma with antecedent lemma. So, okay, coming back to the example. We have a, for translating a verb cut, we have a, normally we have a feature that the, that there is a child personal pronoun. So we just replace a child personal pronoun with child bread. So that's the replacement feature. Similar, the similar one is the replace child and parents lemma, is like including also the parent. Or adding a new feature. So instead of replacing, we add the feature child personal pronoun stays there, and we add a new feature child bread. And the last experiment was to add a feature for every antecedent in the coreference chain. So following the coreference change or coreference links, we're adding all the antecedents as a child. Like this scenario allows us to not retrain the discriminative model. We it took a like bunch of time, so we have to. That's our future work. We have to retrain because I think it has to improve our. We believe. So now, what is the result now? So no significant change in Ble. Some translations were better, some worse. And also, we measured it by NIST, and it's all also like tiny changes there. And when we look at the examples or the data, many errors were caused by the coreference resolver, which is state-of-the-art coreference resolver, but still not, still bad. So the extensions or future work, we'd like to retrain discriminative model, extend our works to NPs, because so I forgot to mention that so far we just look at the pronouns, so maybe that's also the reason for no changes in Ble, because the change can appear just on the pronoun. And to do some detailed manual analysis of changes in NT output. So, okay. Thank you. The code is in the Tecto-MT repository. It's you can check it out from the Tecto-MT repository. It's public for checking out. So it's ufal blah 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 / Tecto-MT. So you can find it there.
Maria and Nina. So just to recap, the Moses string to tree pipeline includes a GHKM rule extractor, which extracts synchronous grammar rules, reduces them to synchronous context-free grammar rules, discarding the internal tree structure. So rather than the nice transducer-style rule at the bottom, we have SCFG rules like I've shown there. So the plan with this project was to start with the simplest possible implementation to modify extract so that it outputs tree structure to the extract files, then we take the most frequently occurring structure for each SCFG rule and retain that, and then that's available for outputting, just if we want to visualize the output, or if we want to implement features or metrics that take the internal structure into account. So the idea was just to implement this, try it out, see if it's efficient enough, or if it's too expensive, then optimize. So the outcome, so it's done, except for a few loose ends. So I'll just go over a few details. So step one, rule extraction, Matthias and Maria worked on this. So extract GHKM will now write the tree fragment in like a pen tree bank style format into the extract file. That's working, except I think there's an issue with parentheses not being escaped, so that needs fixing. And we should add an option so this can be enabled or disabled. But otherwise, that's done and working. Step two was to modify rule scoring so that for each SCFG rule, we look at the count of the internal structures and select the most frequent, then pass that through. So that's done. Matthias implemented that. Also, in the score program, Maria has implemented a couple of example features. So there's a dense feature, which I think just counts up the tree nodes. I think that's NP nodes at the moment. But yeah, it could be all nodes or nodes with particular labels. And there's an example sparse feature, which triggers on the presence of a verb and indicates the type of the verb. I think that's done, but that hasn't been tested out yet. And then for the decoder, we've added a new trace option that's called minus T tree, which outputs detailed information about the rules that were applied and how they were applied, and that now includes the tree structure. That's done. Nina implemented that, and that's working. So given that trace file, we might want to construct the complete tree from that. So Nina is working on a script that takes trace file as input and generates nicely formatted trees. I think that is still in progress, last I checked. Okay, so I tested this out just to see what the effect on the extract files is and on processing times. So it does have some impact on user time. So for 10,000 sentence pairs, we go from just under 2 minutes, 1 minute 59 for extraction to 2 minutes, 6 seconds. So not a big hit. There's a bigger hit on scoring, but like I said, this can be disabled if you don't actually want the tree structure. The file sizes are larger, as you'd expect, so about 50% larger. Okay, and here's a nice before and after picture showing the SCFG rule derivation, and then the same derivation but with the internal tree structure filled in. So this is from the 10,000 sentence pair rule table. This maybe is slightly best case scenario, because I think the sentence is actually from the training data, but I tried a few and it seems to be working. The code is currently in a branch called GHKM, struct GHKM, I think. Something like that, but it will shortly be merged into master. Okay, that's all.
Excellent. So, anybody would like to go next? As I said before, just recommit your updated version, reload this. I did the presentation.
Okay, let's see what happened with this project. Okay, so first thing, bit of a recap. In phrase-based machine translation, people have really, up till recently, used two different types of lexicalized reordering models. The first type is the kind of the usual one, and this goes back to some work by Tillman and some work by Philip, and this I call this maximum likelihood model. Essentially, you just look at your training data and look at the way phrases are oriented with respect to each other, do some counting, and make a maximum likelihood estimate of the probabilities of the different orders, be they monotone, swap, and discontinuous, or whatever, whatever inventory of orderings you decide. You might do some smoothing. And these things just feed into the standard model as probabilities. Maybe the standard Moses put them into six probabilities, but there's nothing really sacred about that. A variant on this, which has been explored by several people, I think starting with Zenz and Nye in 2006, is set of the maximum likelihood estimate to build some kind of classifier using basically lexical features, part of speech features, etc. This, to my knowledge, this isn't widely used, although there's been quite a few papers on it, and people have sometimes got reasonable results from it. So, okay, so now these models work in the same way that the sort of phrase table works. They build some kind of probability distribution, and you add that probability to the standard linear model. Small number of features, and the reason, part of the reason it was done like that was because we were training with MERT, and MERT can't support any more than maybe 15, 20 features. So now that we have better training methods, we can actually tune our translation system with thousands of features, even millions. But the problem is then, what features should we use? So there was this paper this year where Colin Cherry used these sparse features to do some work on reordering. Now these features, when I talk about sparse features, they can take many forms, but essentially there's some kind of predicate on the hypothesis. So it might just say, I don't know, the English word the is the is translated as the German word das, and that could be a predicate. So one advantage of this may be that instead of training for some indirect objective like log likelihood or something like that, we train for a direct objective. Typically, we'd use blue. It might not be the best one, but it's the one that we have set up. So what happened in Cherry's experiments? He got improvements in Chinese English, Arabic English. He layered it on top of the Tillman-style model, so there was also a Tillman-style model. In fact, it was an improvement of the Tillman model, and he found that he used this lattice batch Myra, which we don't have at the moment. I think Matt was implementing it for Joshua, but we have this K-best Myra. Okay, so how does this work? Well, we've got a German sentence, Sie würden gegen Sie stimmen, or something like that, and they would vote against you. There's some reordering going on between the German and the English, reflecting the verb movement. And how does it work? Yeah, for each, I'm assuming that Sie würden is one phrase, gegen Sie is another phrase, and stimmen is another phrase. So each time you translate a new phrase, you insert some sparse features. So there can be various templates. These are not exactly the templates that Colin used, but they're slightly simplified, but you get the idea. So for example, one template might say that you take the left word of the source part of the phrase and you join it to the orientation, and then you maybe put in some marker to indicate that you're using the source left. So for example, Z is monotone, Stimmen is discontinuous because there's a jump, and then Gegen is swap because you've moved back the way. So you generate a whole lot of these features, and in practice you do some, you use a reduced vocabulary, maybe 100 words, the top 100 words, you use some classes. There's a few variants on this, but this is the basic idea. So the other work that which we looked at was this work by Matthias, who took the lexicalized reordering models that we use in phrase-based and applied them to higher models in different ways. So the first work that we looked at was basically an application of the Zenson-Nye reordering model, which he published last year, and then an application of the Tillman-Tastile reordering, which was published this year. So after talking to Matthias, he told us that the second one would work better, though both of them are good, so we decided to base our work on the first one. Okay, so what does this look like? This is what I showed the other day. The basic idea is that we have a rule like x goes to ax1, bx2, and x1z, x2y on the right-hand side, on the target side. Then we add features to show that, you know, in this case, C is x1. You add features to show that, for example, the words under x1 are monotone with respect to the words under x2. And then if you've got the same rule with x2 and x1 reversed, then you add features indicating they're swapped. This is not exactly what we did. We actually looked more closely at what Matthias had done and did something like this. So essentially we're splitting the rule up into blocks. In this case, I've got four blocks, and looking at the orientations of the blocks with respect to each other. So the first block is essentially translating ACD into QR. And in that case, what we do, we can take a couple of different features. So one feature is basically take the boundary word of the left-hand block and look at the orientation. So if I look at these first two blocks, so I've got this QR goes to ACD, and then I've got a jump over to X1. So I'll take that. That is a jump, but I've called them mono and swap. Essentially, I mean forward and backwards. So that's a forward orientation. So I take the boundary words. The boundary word in the first block is D, and the right boundary, and the boundary word on the second block is E, because I'm assuming that X1 covers EF. So that gives me the first two features on the right. And then the other blocks, I've called it swap. It's not really a swap, it's just moving back to the right. So that gives me, again, I get further lexicalized features. So in the end, we did actually manage to implement that. Some variations, either you can take the left word, the right word, or you can take both words. What happened? I did actually try it. I got some blue scores. News commentary test set. I just used the source left variant, top 100 words. I noted that the blue scores went in the right direction, but I noticed that they went a very small amount in the right direction, so I don't really pay much attention to it. But just to prove that the model is working in some sense. And the last thing to show is that the features get weights, which shows that somehow they're in there and they're doing something. The ones that it likes are things like it's saying und swap, so that means you don't swap on und or comma. Maybe that's a good thing. Why is it saying don't have monotone on ein? I'm not really sure. And then at the bottom, the other article, it prefers to keep it monotone. Practice, I'm not really sure why. When I look at this, I'm like, well, why do I have monotone and swap features? Why don't I just give them different values? That's something to think about. But that's all we have now. And the code that I have so far is in Moses in the sparse reordering branch. Okay, thank you. This is all within one rule, so there's no real context involved in this. Well, this is a stateless feat. Well, no, because I'm just looking at one rule. So, I mean, I'm just, wrong one. Yeah, I mean, I'm just supposing I'm applying that rule at the top there, and then I'm only looking at the source word, so I don't have to worry about state. So I just go in and say, well, what did X1 expand as? What did X2 expand as? And look at the orientations there. So it's in that sense, it's simple. It is actually a stateless feature. If I start looking at the target words, I've got to be a bit more careful and think about what I'm doing. But at the moment, it's which one? The okay, which paper was that? I'm not really. I'd have to think about that. Yeah, I guess we're not necessarily implementing exactly what he did, so it's just inspired by, I think, is more accurate. But yeah, I'd have to think about that one.
Thanks. Yeah, so this talk nicely follows up on the previous one by Barry. So I was working in the project with Matt Post, who was implementing the lattice batch Myra in Joshua. And my part of the project is to implement many sparse features. So I wanted to start with some discussion with a quote from a pragmatic programmer that just like, don't leave with broken windows, because I was actually also inspired by the proposal about to like refactor Moses code, but I didn't join that, but still somehow got back into this project as well. So at the project start, Matt showed me how to and where to implement the sparse features in Joshua, which is similar to the way it's done in Moses. And I went ahead and implemented simple one based on the binary features based on the labels. So similar to what Barry showed. A combination of labels, and yeah, possible you can also add the orientation, of course, and many other things. Then I thought, well, this is very easy, so let's just implement a lot of features. But then I also thought that, well, I actually want to know if this actually works before I continue with that. So this was the motivation for moving a bit into how to test this in a smart way. So the one test that's actually also mentioned yesterday is that just the total weight should actually change if you add a new feature. So you can compare it, and you can do it manually, but of course you can also then, yeah, if you have to do this for many features, it will become a bit tedious and buggy, and hard to see if it still works. So I wanted to automate this. And tools I used were JUnit and also ways to reroute input and output so you can like do this all this input to the decoding and extraction of the output and comparison automatically. There are some methods in Java, system in and system out, you can use to do that. And the idea was that on the first run, you actually run the decoder with new features. You set them on, but they don't have weights yet, because basically you don't know yet what are all the features that are fired. So normally this is told to you also by the tuner, like by Maya. But basically you get in the output, you see all the features that are fired. And then I use that to automatically generate a new configuration file that has weights for all these features. So then we feed that new configuration file to a second experiment where we run everything. And in both steps, we collect all the weights. And then we actually, yeah, write a test and we compare this that, okay, we check that basically the, well, list of weights should be similar and also the weights should have changed. So that was, simple except some challenge. And, one thing is with the, global, configuration file, which is actually became a problem when you want to run tests within the same JVM, because there is assumption that only one configuration file is created or only created once, but because it was global variable, it actually gives bugs when you run it twice consecutively within the JVM. So when you are not like actually using it from a script, but within Java, which is what you want to do sometimes when you run this kind of test or script this kind of test in Eclipse. So yeah, first I fixed it by just making a reset method in the configuration file. But then I thought, yeah, this is kind of lame because you, who knows that you have to use this reset method when you're writing a test. So yeah, it shows that global variables are in general not a good idea. So refactoring to the rescue, which is actually showing this picture that why you also need tests, especially when you want to do refactoring, because yeah, if you don't have tests, then you change things and maybe indeed you will break everything, but there are tests, so this is okay. So yeah, I changed that configuration file to be just a object that is passed when necessary and like stored in the main classes of Joshua, like decoder, hypergraph, and so on. And yeah, that's it. And so now this implementation should make it easier and more robust to add more sparse features, because we now have a test to see if they actually do something. And also I think this refactoring is one step towards making testing easier, and that's a good thing. And next steps will be to combine this with this version of BatchMaya and just try it out with lots of these features, and that's it. Yeah, this will be integrated with Joshua. So,
anybody ready?
Okay, so my name is Wang Bin, and I'm going to present the Toolkit test itself in the is Empty Marathon, which is about translation of social media. So, first of all, the topic is available on GitHub, so you can download it. And basically, it's very simple. We have a folder with data and a folder with data. So, about the data, some recap about the media presentation. We took this 3 million microblog parallel data and basically narrowed it down to around 10,500 sentence pairs. And from each, we decided to take like 8,000 for training and 1,250 for development and another 1,250 for testing. And basically, you can see in the data folder that we are in two folders. And basically, you can keep adding stuff. And we have in the scripts folder, we have a run experiment script, which basically builds a model to use using merge the development data and evaluates and tests using the test data. So, some results. So, if we just use the 8,000. And then we try testing with something that's out of domain. So if we use the 300,000 FPS dataset called from the news domain, we can see that the news score is much lower, even though we are using around 35 times more data. And we can see that if we combine these datasets together, we can get some improvement because the FPS dataset actually helps solving some coverage problems that the small news domain data have. So about the token. Have two tokenizers in the tokenizer folder, which basically right now for English we just use the mobile tokenizer, and for Chinese we just use a very simple tokenizer technique, which basically separates all the Chinese characters. And we are still waiting for results for the for our own tokenizers. So that's pretty much it for that. And we also added some normalized data. So basically, we took our paper from EMLP, which is paraphrasing for text normalization, and we normalized the development set of the test sets, which where we can get something like this. So, for instance, we can see that this normalizer, so on the left, you can see the original tweets, and then on the right, you can see the normalized version. So, you can see that it normalizes some abbreviations like brother. Like the comma before brother. We can see that sometimes it actually completely changes some an expression, like you guys are awesome to you are the best, which I'm not. So we should think about how we use these to actually improve translation. And more importantly, sometimes it actually makes the text worse because the normalizer out of things error. So, Fuzzy here, which is like a name of a person, it's actually normalized to play. But you can see that there are some other things like same, which is error, which is normalized to same. And so you can find the normalized versions in the Palo Alto data folders. So yeah, we haven't used them for to compute results, but it shouldn't be that hard to write them. So yeah, thank you.
Could be presented, that one could be presented. It's up to you. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So this is originally the aligner. If this is too little, I can make it bigger. This is a monolingual English to English aligner. So if you have a little, very little demo, toy example, John loves Mary and Mary likes John too, you can just type in here and then you just click align. And then the aligner does the magic job for you. So we got this aligner already. We think it works pretty well. So my task over this MTM was to extend this monolingual aligner to machine translation alignment. Originally, I proposed two parts. First one was to focus on the language part, since a lot of you guys speak, you know, multiple languages. So I thought I might, hire some people to write some language-dependent features for this kind of alignment job, because this is a discriminatively trained aligner, so I need some kind of good features if you know the language. The other one is to focus on the programming part, like extracting some dictionaries from the online dictionary or some similar stuff. The preliminary results was this. Basically, I used a standard French-English alignment dataset. So this dataset has been labeled with the gold standard word alignment. And the state of art alignment error rate is about 7%. Currently now I'm getting around 18% because I used a very limited set of features, only based on dictionary and string similarities. So if anything that the string similarity doesn't cover between French and English words, or the dictionary doesn't cover it, then I couldn't do anything about it. I'm hoping that, you know, with some more effort, my alignment error rate should get below 10%. If I know some French and hire some people to use some more language-dependent features, or draw some statistics from some parallel French-English corpus. So the resulting aligner is actually here. Now this is like adapted to between French and English. So I don't really speak French, and the framework currently has some encoding problem with UTF-8. So this is, but I still believe the sentence one is still French. So you know, you just type whatever you want here, and then you click align. Well, this is like the very best example I can find from my test set, so I'm showing it to you. I think the aligner currently does a very reasonable job, given this very small toy example. Okay, so finally, well, this is a work in progress. I already hosted the code online. If you are kind of getting bored with Giza plus those kind of aligners, you want to work on that, you can just shoot me an email, and then we can sit down over there and then write some feature functions to align between any language pairs if you want. And also, I'm working on integrating this aligner with the Joshua decoder. Hopefully, we can use it in the future. That's all about it.
The fundamental piece of that is wrong.
Okay.
It doesn't actually compute the a trade-off between precision and recall. It makes precision much too high.
Uh-huh.
It's easy to.
I see.
It's easier to see that if you just actually compute precision and recall and actually do that measure.
Yeah.
The 7% number that you're using as a baseline is gained.
It's
so you may be doing much better than you think.
Okay.
Because if you compute just precision and recall and take an F measure, I suspect you're going to be a lot closer to the state of the art.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, there are like two kinds of evaluation measures, error rate or F1 values. I do have those numbers. Thanks for reminding me. I just thought it's like it might be too much trouble to report all the numbers here.
So the AR formula is just wrong. I mean, no one's
looking at it. Oh, gotcha. Oh, okay. All right. I'll take that into account.
If you can give me some reference about this kind of comment, then it's much better for me to write in the paper, you know, instead of just some people telling me at NPM and I shouldn't use the PR. Thanks.
Hello? Okay, hi. So I'm going to talk the second part of following up on Gideon's talk earlier, the forest Mira, which we did for Joshua. Okay, so to review from the project proposal, so Mira is the margin-infused relaxed algorithm. A bunch of people have shown it to be useful in machine translation, mostly David Chang. And then we also have an open source batch implementation that Colin Cherry and George Foster contributed to Moses last year. But it works on the K-best lists that are output by these decoders. And in the original paper, Colin had both a K-best version and a lattice version. And to motivate why you want to extract something more than just your 100 best or 300 best model scoring hypotheses. This is a picture from David Chang's 2012, I think it was a JMLR paper. So it shows, this is a random sampling of the search space where he's plotted model score versus loss, which is 1 minus blue score. And if you take the 100 best, you're just getting this very small piece of the search space, and you're discriminating the best item in that red box against the worst item from that red box. And really what you'd like to do is grab something from a wider a more representative piece of the search space. So their hope and fear translations are defined as the hope one is something that has a high model score and does well in blue, and then the fear translations are items that get a high model score but a very low blue score. So you'd like to push the weights down on those. So our project was to implement this. We kind of scaled down our ambitions. We didn't get to Moses, basically. Pretty much have this done in Joshua. So the three parts of the approach were we'd write some mini-featured feature functions so that we could test this with lots of features, and then was to do the blue approximation and then the forest rescoring so we could do proper updating. Okay. Okay, so a big piece of this is to use an approximate version of blue, because in order to do forest rescoring, we need the metric to factor across the hyper edges in the search graph. So basically the way you do this is the pieces that make blue non-factorizable are this sentence-wide brevity penalty and the count clipping. So basically you just do away with those. So when you're incrementing your precision scores for different n-grams, don't clip accounts. That's easy enough. You can actually do you can do local clipping, so you don't have to count a number of times if it occurs on a single hyper edge. But you can't do the global clipping. And then the other part is to do the brevity penalty. You just you know the length of the hypothesis wherever you are in the chart, and you know the proportion of the input you've consumed for that chart item since you know the span. So you can just scale the average reference length to that proportion. And then the other major piece is that you can't store scores since blue isn't linear. So most features you can just, when you merge two hyper edges, you can just add the scores. You can't do that with blue. You have to add the sufficient statistics and then recompute the blue score. So that's kind of a pain because you have to throw or keep these sufficient statistics around. And so I'm just going to show you a picture of how that's done. So basically, along each hyper edge, we need to maintain these statistics, which is all the n-gram counts, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then the length of the hypothesis. So that's easy for terminal productions like this one. So we have X goes to Barack Obama. Here I'm just showing the target side of the rule. So if our reference is Barack Obama, comma, president, we have two unigrams that we've matched and a single bigram. No 3 grams, no 4 grams, and the length is 2. Okay, so now when you have rules with non-terminals on the source and target side, you have to incorporate just the statistics that are added by applying that rule. So here's a picture. We're applying this rule above the Barack Obama rule that we already applied. So we have this, we have the n-gram context from that rule below. And this Barack Obama bar president represents the fact that we need to compute blue statistics that are fired by this rule, but we only want to count n-grams that overlap that boundary. So we can count unigrams from the rule itself, from president here, we get a 1 gram. But we can only count n-grams, we don't want to recount Barack Obama, because that's stored in the sufficient statistics for the previous hyperedge. So no bigrams cross this boundary. So we basically just get a single unigram here for this edge. And then if we want to take basically the inside or Viterbi sufficient statistics, we just add these. So we get a vector that's 31003 by adding these together. And by adding them all the way up, you can kind of percolate the scores for a hypothesis all the way up the chart. And then there's a little bit more complexity when you do k-best extraction, since you're following different paths through the hypergraph, and you have to just make sure that you grab in a bottom-up post-order traversal, grab the statistics and percolate them up. Okay, so we did this, and then we did experiments. We have a German-English model built on Europarl and Common Crawl, tuning and testing and some of the NUSE test sets. And then we ran Mira for 8 iterations and took for the test data the model that had the best tuning score. And this is a very small feature set, just 10 features, kind of standard feature set. So here's a picture of the dev set blue scores for Mira. And then, so that's the blue line. And then Forest Mira, where we have k equals 100. So we rescore the forest twice, which means that we actually have 300 hypotheses for each sentence with a k equals 100. And we have 900 for the k equals 300. So that just shows you that, for one, we are getting significantly higher dev scores with a forest mirror. So it's doing something, and it's doing something good, but those aren't reflected on the test data. So somehow we're overfitting with just 10 parameters. So there's a little bit more work to do to figure this out. So we're losing about half a point to three-quarters of a point in blue score when we go to the test set. So it's hard to overfit with 10 parameters, but we managed to do it. So missing, one of the things, an obvious thing to look at, is we haven't included this rolling decaying blue corpus stats, which are actually pretty important. So normally you don't want to just compute the blue score on the sentence, but you want to pretend there's kind of like a pseudo corpus behind you, which isn't too big, otherwise any changes you make won't have any effect at all. So we need to incorporate that into the k-best extraction. And we haven't tested on large feature sets, obviously. So Gideon has been building some of these, and we'll get to that in the near future. So in summary, shows promise. I think it's going to work, and I'll have better numbers in the near future. So, Cherry and Foster were telling the truth.